seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner and Badeau and Gorham versus Palin Park.
May it please the court, Mr. Gracie will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Sweat will present the rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court. My name is Thomas Gracie, and I represent petitioner Charles B. Gorham. First, let me thank you for granting the petition for review in this case. This is an important case, the case of first impression in Texas. To the best of my knowledge, there have been only two cases decided by Texas courts addressing the disclaimer statute. Neither of those cases address the situation we have here today, which is particularly the wording of Section 37AG, which acts to stop a party seeking to disclaim. There's only four essential facts that were needed for decision. They were enough for Judge Fred Clark when he granted the motion for summary judgment. These four essential facts are not in dispute. In fact, the respondent takes the same position. The facts are undisputed, and decision should be go in his favor.
Okay, do you agree with that then? That we can render summary judgment on the cross petition if we disagree with your position? There's nothing to send back. I believe you just said it was all law. So do you agree?
Yes, there's nothing to send back.
Nothing to send back. Okay.
Yes. May I first be finished?
The first essential nucleus of facts is, this is on a timeline. It's in the brief as well. Exhibit to the handout of court. The first thing is the creation of beneficiary status. That was the execution by the decedent of a will and her codicil.
Well, that's the whole question. When you said a creation of beneficiary status, the question is whether she was a beneficiary before the death.
Exactly, Your Honor. Justice O'Neill, as soon as Rublin Perdue signed that will, she designated her daughter, Elaine Perdue Hale, as her beneficiary, as the property at issue in this case.
But doesn't 37A have a special definition for beneficiary?
Yes, Your Honor, it does. It's right here.
And it says
beneficiary
includes,
so it's perhaps even more than that, but includes a person who would have been entitled, if the person had not made the disclaimer, that's Ms. Hale, if she had made that disclaimer, to receive property as a result of the death of another person by inheritance under a will. That's exactly who Ms. Hale is. She's a beneficiary, and absent the disclaimer, which is under attack, the essential issue in this case, she was a person who was a beneficiary because she was entitled to receive property as a result of the will of her mother.
But doesn't the statute sort of contemplate, just this 37A, contemplate that there has to be a death before someone can become a beneficiary, just by the way it's worded? For example, when it talks about filing a disclaimer, it says it has to be filed in the county where the decedent died. How would you know that until someone died? How could you ever... there's certain statements in the statute.
There's two questions I think the court has asked. One is, when can you disclaim? And basically, the disclaimer right arises after death. That's when the legislature said you have a 9-month time window to file that. But it doesn't link to the separate question of what is a beneficiary and when does beneficiary status arise? We contend, Your Honor, that the law in Texas has long been the case that the beneficiary status arises when the property interest arises, and that's when an expectancy is created. That's when you're named in the will. That's what the common parlance of Texas is. I'm a beneficiary under the will.
But in 37A, as Justice O'Neill was talking about, it talks about a beneficiary being a person who receives property, who would have been entitled to receive property as a result of the death of another person. Is this a different definition of beneficiary that might appear elsewhere in the law for specific purposes of 37A?
Well,
it specifically is tied not to just the will, but as a result of death.
The court, I think, of appeals made the mistake, and I think this, Your Honor's question perhaps carries forward that same mistake. The definition of 37A regulates the process and manner of disclaimer. It It's not meant to be an exclusive, specially restricted definition of beneficiary.
It's not even an exclusive definition. It's an inclusive definition, which includes the rest of Texas law as to what beneficiary is.
But it says, do you put any significance to the word would have been entitled? Instead of, it seems like under your argument, if it included an expectancy, if a beneficiary included someone who had an expectancy, that it would say who could have been entitled. I mean, if we're going to look at the plain meaning, well, it would have been entitled upon death. Seems to.
The question then becomes, at what time frame do we view this definition? My point, and the point of our brief, is that that time frame is at the time of the disclaimer. At the time of the disclaimer, absent that disclaimer, would this person have been entitled to receive the property at that time? And the reason that is so, Your Honor, is because the heart of this case is disclaimer after acceptance. This statute, which the Court of Appeals read into what I've highlighted as read, all these other requirements, is very straightforward. No disclaimer shall be effective. It doesn't say an insert there, provided it occurs after death. It says no disclaimer shall be effective after the acceptance of the property. Again, not limited to whether it's accepted before or after the death.
Wait, how can you accept the property before death?
By conveying it, by using it, by possessing it, by claiming it, by leading third parties to their detriment.
Well, no, okay, leading third parties to their detriment. Third parties know that the pledge of an expectancy is a pretty iffy proposition. It can lapse by the predeceasing of the beneficiary, for example. Right?
There is only...
That's right, by the predeceasing of the beneficiary. And this statute is written in such a way that they say if you file a disclaimer, it has the effect of there being a predeceasing of the beneficiary. So, I mean, you'd agree in the first instance that any creditor who relies on the conveyance of an expectancy is taking a big chance of beneficiary predeceasing, being disinherited, will changing, things being amended.
Your Honor, I will acknowledge big risk for two reasons. One, there's only two ways that a beneficiary status can be defeated. Actually, three. One, a predeceasing situation. Mrs. Hale is a lot younger than her mother. Likelihood, low. Number two, the will being changed. The salient fact here is that Mrs. Badu, the decedent, was in a guardianship. She lacked the mental capacity to manage her affairs. Very unlikely the will would be changed. The final way that beneficiary status could be defeated in advance of the death would be a renunciation, which that same statute basically says renunciation and disclaimer mean the same thing. You don't want the gift. The courts have expressed that as an offer by the estate that is rejected. So, Your Honor, I do not agree that the risk of dealing with an expectancy was iffy or low. Here, it was high that it would be realized. Mrs. Hale used her expectancy to secure legal services. And I use that word secure in two manners. One, to obtain them, first of all, and then from the creditor lawyer's perspective, to give him some source of collateral for the payment of a fee. The essence of this case is that expectancies may be used in Texas and conveyed. That's the definition, the fundamental definition in the property code. The property code states a person may make an inter vivos conveyance of an inheritance that commences in the future.
Yes, an expectancy can be conveyed.
Yes.
And there's language in this Hale versus Holland case that says that it's assignable in equity for valuable consideration, and where the expectancy has fallen into possession, it will be enforceable. But if it doesn't ever fall into possession, it's not enforceable. And isn't that the intent of this language about there being a death? It doesn't fall into possession until a death, and until you possess it, you can't accept it.
Well, I respectfully disagree, Your Honor, because if you can convey a certain property, if you can gain value from that property, benefit from that property, use that property, then you have a property interest. There's no question about it, I believe, under the case law, that you can deal with your expectancies, you can pledge your expectancies, you can obtain credit for those expectancies.
And they're still expectancies, though. If they don't fall into possession, you have nothing.
If they don't mature, Mr. Gorham had a deed of trust that was contingent upon the will not being changed and Mrs. Hale not dying before her mother.
It's not just possession, but then, is it?
Sorry?
You don't need to possess it. Is it necessary that you possess it?
You don't need to possess it. The statute
can dominion or control.
It is broader than that, exactly, Your Honor. Because what it says is the definition. Plan Rector exception has previously taken possession, I'm using yes, the court's question, or the conjunctive, or exercised dominion or control of such property.
In the capacity of beneficiary, which is the question.
I'm sorry?
Well, if in the capacity of beneficiary is the issue, because if it's not in the capacity of beneficiary, we don't get the control of possession.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. That's the limitation. But what other capacity was Mrs. Hale acting in when she voluntarily exercise dominion and control sufficient to convey property in trust under a deed of trust? That, in our opinion, is acting in the capacity of beneficiary. There is no other capacity she could have been acting in. The Court of Appeals suggested no other capacity she could have been acting in. Then the court has to go immediately to the final straw and say, okay, subsequent to that, Mrs. Hale filed a disclaimer in proper form within the proper time frame. Is it valid? That's the only question I believe before the court. And the answer is no, because no disclaimer shall be effective after acceptance of the property by the beneficiary.
Any question?
For the purpose of the section.
Excuse me, counsel, your time's up if you're not answering the question. And I think you're not, but does anybody have another question there? The court is ready to hear arguments from response.
May it please the court, Mr. Parker will present argument for the response.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Scott Parker, counsel for the appellee. I felt compelled after hearing the respondent earlier in the prior case telling you that this was his first time before the Supreme Court, and this is not only after my first appeal ever, this is also my first time before the Supreme Court. So it's kind of a special thing to be here before you, and I really appreciate you all giving me a petition for review. The decision that is made on the case before you today is twofold. Basically, it's whether to reinforce the Texas Probate Code and pass rulings or to change it. And if we change it, then we're going to be opening the floodgates, of course, as you all always hear, for new litigation from creditors and so forth. The case also relies on the interpretation of 37A of the Probate Code and also what violates a no-contest clause. What is more than a mere filing of a no-contest clause? I have two issues that I'd like to discuss today. One is, was a disclaimer executed by Hale valid and effective as a matter of law? And two, what constitutes more than a mere filing to violate a no-contest clause of a will? In my first issue, I'll show that the disclaimer executed by Hale was valid and effective as a matter of law and therefore should be upheld as against all. And in the second issue, I'll try to paint a picture of case law and facts, in this case, of what constitutes more than a mere filing to violate a no-contest clause of a will.
Okay, Mr. Parker, on the issue of the validity of the disclaimer,
yes,
you have a deed of trust lien on this expectancy.
Yes, sir.
And it applied to a house. On the date that the codicil was probated, what was the status of the house?
The date the codicil was probated, to my recollection, the house,
I'm talking about the ownership of this house.
Mrs. Bedu was still living in the house at that time, if I have my dates correct. When the codicil was filed?
Right. Well, when the codicil was probated, what was the status of the ownership of the house?
When the codicil was probated, that would have to have been after the death.
Right.
The status of the house, it was in the hands of the estate for Mrs. Bedu. Are you asking me where did the property vest as under the probate code?
Well, what was the status of this house when the deceased, she dies, and now what's the status of the house?
I think
it goes to the heir.
I think I know where you're going. All property vests in someone at the immediate time of death. Therefore, it would have vested in Mrs. Hale at the exact second at which Mrs. Badu died, if that's answering the question.
Now, the probate code permits Ms. Hale to disclaim any interest within a certain period of time and not suffer any sort of adverse consequences as a result of this device, correct?
Yes, sir.
But at the point in time that the ownership vests in Ms. Hale, it has a deed of trust on it from Ms. Hale for the value of that house.
Yes, sir.
So when she attempts to execute the disclaimer, hasn't she already exercised control by transferring an interest in that home?
No, sir. I would argue that she did not.
But she owned it. She had the power to convey that. That expectancy has now been realized. She has an effective lien on this house. Why isn't that an exercise of control over the house? Even assuming that somehow she wasn't a beneficiary before she executed the lien, she now has a document that she's executed, mm-hmm. exercising authority over that house. The house is vested in her as of the date of her mother's death.
Correct.
How is she now able to disclaim under the statute?
Well, under the statute, it states that as against all, you can disclaim as if you predecease the decedent. Therefore, you have to think of it. I would have to think of it in the analysis of, you take the interpretation of the following events. The deed of trust was done. The disclaimer, then the will directing the property to the administration, prior to its distribution to the beneficiaries, and all these things occurred simultaneously, the same second, if we might say, because of the death. And because under 37A of the probate code, it definitively states that it relates back for all purposes to the death of the decedent in the cases before a court of appeals. And therefore, as I'm understanding it, that it's naming someone in a will that's in an offer to them to accept that property. And so I'm going to take that analysis one step further, because one can't dispose of something that one doesn't have. Then I'm going to say that you can't mortgage what you never owned as well. To answer your question, it relates back as against all creditors, because she never exercised actual dominion and control over that property.
Mr. Parker?
Yes, sir.
Can you give me an example of 37AG? What would exercising dominion or control look like?
The only way I could give you what would exercising dominion and control look like, it would be through the case law I've read that was prior holdings before, and what the prior courts held were someone holding it as against all others after a person dies, or encumbering that property after that person died. Doing anything adverse to that property as against others after the time of death, not prior to, as the Court of Appeals correctly ruled that a beneficiary cannot act prior to a death of a decedent as to that property. And when Mrs. Hale gave a deed of trust and a promissory note to an attorney that was a probate attorney for his services, that had knowledge of disclaimers, had knowledge that had other remedies available to secure his payment of his fees. That was prior to her acting as a beneficiary under the probate code. Clearly, under 37AG, under 37A of the Texas Probate Code, it says as a beneficiary.
Have you looked for any legislative history behind the 37? Specifically in terms of the part that says in the capacity of beneficiary, why that language was included?
I tried to look into legislative history on Westlaw, and I couldn't find anything in the statute particularly as to why it was stated that definition. No, I couldn't find anything. Not that it's not there. I could not find anything as to why beneficiary was defined in the way it was.
Is this statute like any other statutes of other states that you know of? Or do they all differ?
There are some other states that hold a similar statute to this. As to what exact state they are, I couldn't tell you right now.
But have they interpreted, are there any other states, cases that have interpreted that in the capacity of beneficiary language if there is similar statute?
I don't know right off the top of my head, Your Honor. I know that there are some cases that are out of other states that we use in our brief that say similar results as to someone prior to a person dying and so forth and not acting as a beneficiary until after the death, but not on point to this case. This case is pretty unique as to that. Yes, sir.
In the world of probate jurisprudence, can you be a beneficiary before death?
I would have to say no. I mean, I would have to say that based on the probate code specifically, and not the property code, not the tax code, not any other code, the probate code under the Texas law states that a beneficiary is after.
What status do you have then? When she signs the will, you have an expectancy. What is your status?
Your status is of a future interest is what I'd like to call it, or an expectancy. You can get hit by a bus tomorrow, and that interest goes away because you predeceased as the will of the four corners of the will that is to be interpreted by under the probate code states that, you know, if the party puts in there that if this person predeceases me, it will pass as though that, you know, to this other people, and that clause is in there to protect people if they die or whatever, so their property will stay within their family and pass through.
So you can mortgage that interest.
I'm saying you couldn't.
You can't mortgage.
I'm arguing that you couldn't mortgage something that you don't own.
So the future interest, the expectations that you can't mortgage.
How would you mortgage something you never owned? I don't know how you would do that. So, no, sir.
But the law says you can.
That you can mortgage your future interest. Under the property code,
the case law says that an expectancy can be assigned. The Hale versus Heron had that nearly a decade ago. I mean, a century. And I don't think that's ever been overruled. So you agree that an expectancy is assignable. It can be mortgaged. The question is, can it then be disclaimed?
Correct.
That is the question.
She said it correctly. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
Just trying to be sure of your position.
Well, my position, of course, is the disclaimer is valid and effective against all, of course. That's what my position is.
What do you call a person who owns an expectancy or a future interest?
A person that is a contingent
beneficiary.
A what?
Contingent beneficiary. My second issue, if I may, would is talking about the violation. What's more than a mere filing of a no contest clause of a will? And whether Mr. Badu's actions fall strictly within those requirements under the no contest clause of Mrs. Badu's will, it's stated in there directly towards Mr. Badu, her son, that if in any way he tries to redirect or hinder or contest my will, then not only is he cut out of the will, but his son, my grandson, is also will not take into this will. And more than a mere filing means if you file a turnover order in a case, and it states in the state of Hamill, or state of Hamill, that a mere filing of a will contest is not sufficient to invoke such a harsh remedy of forfeiture under no contest clauses if it is later dismissed prior to any proceedings being had. And in the present case, the facts show that the acts of filing the turnover order and arguing it before the trial court falls strictly within the no contest clause of the will by Mr. Badu attempting to change the way in which the executor intended, or I'm sorry, by trying to change the way in which the decedent intends to pass the property.
Well, the decedent intended to pass the property to your client. How is this a will contest? Isn't your opponent trying to enforce what the decedent said when she executed her will?
That's an excellent question. In her will, it specifies, though, that if, and I think in a lot of wills it does in Texas, that if the executor needs to lease my property, to sell it and do other things with it before passing it to the persons I intend for it to go to take care of funeral expenses, to take care of anything, then they can do that. They have that power to do it.
But that's not what this disclaimer is thought to do. I mean, that doesn't sound applicable.
You mean the no contest clause?
I mean, I'm getting a disconnect here. This turnover procedure, the proceeding that was filed, and the action that was taken here was an intent to make sure the property passed in accordance with the terms of the will, not to undo what the will prescribed.
But he was trying to direct the court to give him the property, not to let it go through the estate as it was wished to do in the will. And it's,
well, but in order for there to be the turnover, it would have had to have passed under the will in a way that would allow him then to collect the money that he claimed he was due as a creditor. Otherwise, he couldn't stand in the shoes of the creditor unless it actually passed under the will the way the testator intended.
Well, he could have allowed it to pass through the will properly by waiting the allotted time of after 9-month period, or by waiting until the property actually was put in her name or she exercised dominion and control over such property.
But my point is yes, that the whole point of the turnover procedure was not to undo what the testator intended under the will. It was, in fact, to enforce and make sure the property passed in a way that was prescribed by the will.
Well, they filed an application to sell the property also, so I would have to disagree in a way with what you're saying.
The only reason they could sell the property or get it via a turnover order was for it to pass in connection with the way the will prescribed that it should pass. Otherwise, we wouldn't have any claim to it.
But doesn't the court have the power to direct the property in any way that they feel necessary?
I'm just saying, my question to you, though, is
yes, ma'am.
The effect and the basis for the turnover was relied upon actually enforcing the will as written and having the property pass the way the will prescribed that it should pass.
I didn't see it that way. I saw it the way that he was trying to tell the court or ask the court to turn this property over to him.
On what basis?
On the basis of him being your creditor. I agree with that
creditor
part.
Of the devotee under the will.
No, ma'am, a creditor himself. He was a creditor, had a judgment himself. So it was an individual that was trying to turn over this property. He was also, though, expecting, you know, to inherit from it as well, yes. But if you read clearly her no contest clause, it says in any way alter or, you know, change the way in which my will is distributed anyway. I mean, the will should stand for itself. It should just almost stand up almost and say, this is how my wishes are, as if she was telling it on a video that this is how I want it to go. I want it to do this, 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 and this. And he was trying to change it indirectly.
But would it be a correct statement to say that the turnover order was filed in the other court that issued the judgment? Is that correct?
Yes, sir, it was.
Filed in the probate court.
And it was also filed in the probate court. It was filed in a separate court.
In what respect?
It was filed in a separate court based on the judgment that he had, Mr. Bedu had, against Hale. But then they also filed it in the probate court after the decedent passed, as against the property that Hale was intended to receive, but had not yet received through the probate process. Yes, property vests immediately upon death of someone in somebody in Texas. It has to, for somebody to be responsible for it, taxes, whatever. But I think he jumped the gun here is what I'm trying to say, and he also mentioned it more than mere filing. It says more than mere filing is anything done after that filing. And he, or his, Mr. Bedu argued in court, in the probate court, the mere mentioning of turnover, if I say turnover, or arguing for it, it seems like they drew a line that he passed. And that is more than a mere filing.
What did he file in the probate court? Here's my order from this other district court showing that I have an order to turn over the house.
He filed a motion with the case number of the probate court in the decedent's case, requesting a turnover order and an application for the sale of the property for the benefit of himself, that the judgment that he had, to satisfy his judgment. So I guess what you're saying, yes, sir, that would be correct in saying that's what he did. In prayer, I would pray that the court overrules the Court of Appeals as to my point of error number 3 and holds that Hale's disclaimer was valid and effective as a matter of law. And in saying that, it reminds me also of something that they said that's outside my prayer, that here equity wouldn't even apply because even if it was considered in this matter, because Mr. Gorham never filed or requested anything under the 5-prong test or proved it in the live pleadings before the trial court as to equity of estoppel being applied. Whether or not it's being used to decide today as to the disclaimer, it was never even pled in the live pleadings of the trial court. And even if it did, he's an attorney. Mrs. Hale couldn't have told him, he was a probate attorney for that matter because he was representing her in a probate matter. She couldn't have hidden the fact that there was a disclaimer, that she could have got hit by a bus. The will was changed somehow. Miraculously, Mrs. Badu stood up and said, I'm well now today. You know, and the doctor said, she's 110%. I want to change my will and I'll give it to the orphanage. He couldn't fall within the 5-prong test, which you need all of those in order to satisfy estoppel of inequity. Estoppel of equity. But I missed that and I wanted to mention that. I'm sorry. And the second part of my prayer is that the no contest clause be strictly enforced as against Ed Badu Jr. If y'all have any questions.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brett Swiss and I represent Ed Badu Jr. in this matter. I want to briefly address the no contest issue and then move on to the more substantive issue, which is the disclaimer. The court is correct in perceiving that the no contest clause is virtually the turnover within a separate action. Mr. Badu was acting in his capacity as a judgment creditor, not as a beneficiary, and certainly, as cited in our brief, there have been a lot more egregious cases in this state that have not even come close to constituting a violation of the no contest clause as a will contest. This is not a contest of the will. In fact, as Justice Hankinson pointed out, he needed to enforce the will to have the judgment creditor status and have the property returned. So there's no question that we were looking to uphold the will, not challenge the will.
The turnover process simply presents to the judgment debtor an order that they turn over whatever interest they have in a piece of property.
That's correct.
And Mr. Badu goes to the probate court to try and get the probate court to do something different with the house than the order, than the will said. The will said, give the house to my daughter. And Mr. Badu goes to the probate court and say, don't give the house to the daughter, give the house to me.
No.
Didn't that change the will?
What he does is he goes to the probate court, or not even the probate court, he goes to the other court. Which
no, I understand going to the other court simply says enter this turnover which directs Hale to turn over whatever interest she has in the house. But he now goes over to the probate court, doesn't he, and asks the judge in the probate court to take control of the house?
No.
Okay, what happened?
There was merely a declaratory judgment action request in the probate proceeding, which just declare that I'm entitled to proceed with my turnover order in the other action, despite what's pending here in the probate court. And to further answer your question,
he was asking the probate court, don't take this case, let me go pursue it.
He said he wanted to have declaratory relief that he was entitled to proceed with the turnover order because that house now is in the probate estate. And to further answer your question, he wasn't saying turn it over to me, he's saying I am now Ms. Hale as judgment creditor, not that I'm changing the will, but I am Ms. Hale. Still passing through Ms. Hale, but that's me. I'm standing in her shoes. So they're not looking to change the will. In fact, it's interesting that if we were to uphold the disclaimer in this statute, we would essentially be doing the same thing as well. So now has Mr. Parker and has Ms. Hale violated the no contest clause of the will as well? I don't think they would admit that they have, but that's essentially the same effect that would have.
Let me ask you real quick. Can I direct you to your co-counsel's exhibit about the statute? I want to make sure we're on the same page in line. 37 AG. it says taken possession or exercise dominion.
Correct.
I believe that's the statute I have in front of me says and control.
I'm not sure. I think the point you were trying to make was taken possession disorder, correct?
But exercise dominion and control, and how can you exercise control if you don't have the property?
Well, this brings up an interesting point. Before Mr. Parker, at least can see it too, that Ms. Hale was a contingent beneficiary, which I would say is a beneficiary under the statute. But I think to really look at it in terms of what Justice O'Neill was asking before, let's look at what is a beneficiary. Somebody who would have been entitled, not his, would have been entitled, if not making a disclaimer, to receive property as a result of the death of another person. Well, let's look at the definition of property under the same exact statute. The term property as used in this section includes all legal and equitable interests, whether present or future, whether vested or contingent.
Are you saying present or future interests includes expectancy?
Absolutely. That's exactly what it includes. And I think there's some confusion here in this case that's kind of pervaded the whole thing. The property we're talking about that she exercised dominion and control over is not the physical house. It's not the physical house. The property she exercised dominion and control over is her inheritance rights in the house. And as far back as 1990, when the will was executed, she had those inheritance rights. In 1994, when she executed the deed of trust, she exercised dominion and control over those rights because, you'll see.
Was she a beneficiary at that point?
Absolutely. She was a beneficiary in 1990 when the will was executed. Here's the point. The term property in the probate statute we're looking at specifically says that that property is all legal and equitable interests, whether present or future, whether vested or contingent. What did she bequeath under the deed of trust? She bequeathed her all of her present and future rights, interests in the property, including her expectancy of ownership by reason of inheritance from the trust. So she definitely has pledged that property. And again, the point is the property is the inheritance interest, not the physical property. That's what she exercised dominion and control over, and that's what the deed of trust is related to, and that's what Mr. Badu's judgment claim is related to, is the interest in the property. Now, to get to the physical house, yes, you have to take her interest in the property. So that's the point. I think that's a lot is being missed in this case.
Well, what's the purpose of the disclaimer statute?
The purpose of the disclaimer statute is, as I understand it, it really kind of came up under the IRS regs to allow people to avoid adverse tax consequences by basically
but
having
isn't
property.
Isn't there a purpose that came up through the common law as well?
I think the essential purpose is to not force somebody to take on property for whatever adverse consequences that may have.
For benefit of creditors.
That being one possible thing. But again, the legislature, and this may be a derivation of the common law, said that you can do that as long as you have not previously and contradictorily accepted the property. And that's what we're dealing with here. I agree with you. If this was a case where there was no acceptance, obviously she's entitled to disclaim. I think the case law and the statute is very clear on it. But if she previously accepted the property, which she clearly did in this case by pledging it under the deed of trust.
So the disclaimer would be good as to the turnover, or as to the general judgment creditor.
I'm sorry,
the disclaimer would be effective as to the general judgment.
Had she not previously accepted the property, it would be effective as to any creditor.
But I thought you were saying the deed of trust is what constituted the acceptance.
She accepted the property, she accepted it. You go live in a house, you live in it. You can't live in it as to the acceptance is acceptance. You either accept
Saying it's not the deed of trust that's the acceptance, but her living in it?
No. I'm saying that the deed of trust is the acceptance of it, but her act of acceptance, she's accepted the house. The statute doesn't say you accept it in one way and not in another. You've either accepted the house, the property, or you haven't accepted the property. And that's what she's done in this case.
Well, I'm still confused. What act do you say constitutes acceptance?
The acceptance is her pledging of the house, I'm sorry, of her interest, inheritance interest in the house under the deed of trust.
So it's the specific pledge, the deed of trust.
That is the act of acceptance in this case. That's correct.
But how would that affect a general judgment creditor?
The statute doesn't break it down to whether you've accepted it as one person or another. It just says you've accepted your disclaimer is invalid. It invalidates the disclaimer's entirety. There is no provision in the statute which calls for partial invalidity. I mean, it's invalid or it's not invalid. You've either accepted it or you haven't accepted it.
Would you agree with opposing counsel that there's nothing to send back to the trial court if we were to go that way? I mean, the Court of Appeals just sort of said we send it back to determine.
I agree that there's not really much factual dispute. You probably caught that from our discussion here this morning.
Okay, so you agree we could render on the cross?
I think we would request that you render because I think it's an appropriate summary judgment case.
So there's no equity argument left?
Ms. Bracey may differ with me as to his mind, but insofar as I'm concerned, there's not.
Can you have an understanding?
Sure.
This may be parsing this pretty fine, but I heard you say that acceptance occurred when she pledged her expectation of receiving the inheritance. But the disclaimer relates to her not, the disclaimer relates to the actual house, not her expectation of receiving the house.
She disclaimed her inheritance rights. That's what a disclaimer does. And what did she pledge before? She pledged her inheritance rights. She accepted what she disclaimed. That's the point. And that's why I wanted to bring that point before the court. We're not talking about the physical house being the problem. Again, under the definition of property, we're talking about her inheritance rights, equitable interests. And that's what she pledged before and accepted. That's what she's attempting to disclaim. That's what Bracey's client, my client, the interest we're trying to get to as creditors of Ms. Hale. And that's, again, I think a point that's been glossed over in this case all along, and it's very important for the court to understand in making a ruling on the decision.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in all of this morning's cases, which will be submitted to the court on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Mm-hmm. All rise. Oh, yay, oh, yay, oh, yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.